It is activity and not flesh. And if sex itself does not come across as flesh penetrated with desire, but as a cleverly used tool, woman will feel the same repulsion. Besides, anything else will seem to confirm the woman's failure to experience a normal woman's feelings. Stekel notes, after many, many observations, that all the desire of so-called frigid women aims at the norm. They want to reach orgasm like a normal woman. No other process satisfies them morally. Man's attitude is thus of extreme importance. If his desire is violent and brutal, his partner feels changed into a mere thing in his arms. But if he is too self-controlled, too detached, he does not constitute himself as flesh. He asks woman to make herself object without her being able to have a hold on him in return. In both cases, her pride rebels. To reconcile her metamorphosis into a carnal object with the demands of her subjectivity, she must make him her prey as she makes herself his. This is often why the woman obstinately remains frigid. If the lover lacks seductive techniques, if he is cold, negligent, or clumsy, he fails to awaken her sexuality. Or he leaves her unsatisfied. But if he is virile and skillful, he can provoke reactions of rejection. Woman fears his domination. Some can find pleasure only with timid, inept, or even almost impotent men, ones who do not scare them away. It is easy for a man to awaken hostility and resentment in his mistress. Resentment is the most common source of feminine frigidity. In bed, the woman makes the male pay for all the affronts she considers she has been subjected to by an insulting coldness. Her attitude is often one of an aggressive inferiority complex. Since you do not love me, since I have flaws preventing me from being liked, and since I am despicable, I will not surrender to love, desire and pleasure either. This is how she exacts vengeance both on him and on herself, if he has humiliated her by his negligence, if he has aroused her jealousy, if he has declared himself too slowly, if he has made her his mistress when she desired marriage. The complaint can appear suddenly and set off this reaction, even during a relationship that began happily. The man who caused this hostility can rarely succeed in undoing it. A persuasive testimony of love or appreciation may, however, sometimes modify the situation. It also happens that women who are defiant or stiff in their lover's arms can be transformed by a ring on their finger. Happy, flattered, their conscience at peace, they let all their defenses fall. But a newcomer, respectful, in love, and delicate, can best transform the disenchanted woman into a happy mistress or wife. If he frees her from her inferiority complex, she will give herself to him ardently. Stekel's work Frigidity in Woman essentially focuses on demonstrating the role of psychic factors in feminine frigidity. The following examples clearly show that it is often an act of resentment of the husband or lover. Miss G.S. had given herself to a man while waiting for him to marry her, while insisting on the fact that she did not care about marriage, that she did not want to be attached. She played the free woman. In truth, she was a slave to morality like her whole family, but her lover believed her and never spoke of marriage. Her stubbornness increased more and more until she became apathetic. When he finally did ask her to marry him, she took her revenge by admitting her numbness and no longer wanting to hear anything about a union. She no longer wanted to be happy. She had waited too long. She was consumed by jealousy and waited anxiously for the day he proposed so she could refuse it proudly. Then she wanted to commit suicide just to punish her lover in style. A very jealous woman who until then had found pleasure with her husband imagines that her husband is cheating on her while she was ill. Coming home, she decides to be cold to her husband. She would never be aroused by him again because he did not appreciate her and used her only when in need. Since her return, she has been frigid. At first, she used little tricks not to be aroused. She pictured to herself that her husband was flirting with her girlfriend. But soon orgasm was replaced by pain. A young 17-year-old had an affair with a man and derived intense pleasure from it. Pregnant at 19, She asked her lover to marry her. He was ambivalent and advised her to get an abortion, which she refused to do. 3 weeks later, he declared he was ready to marry her, and she became his wife. But she never forgave those 3 tormented weeks and became frigid. Later on, a talk with her husband overcame her frigidity. Mrs. N.M. learns that 2 days after the wedding, her husband went to see a former mistress. The orgasm she had had previously disappeared forever. She was obsessed by the thought that she no longer pleased her husband, whom she thought she had disappointed. That is the cause of frigidity for her. Even when a woman overcomes her resistance and eventually experiences vaginal pleasure, not all her problems are eliminated. The rhythm of her sexuality and that of the male do not coincide. She is much slower to reach orgasm than the man. The Kinsey report states, "For perhaps 3/4 of all males, orgasm is reached within 2 minutes after the initiation of the sexual relation." Considering the many upper-level females who are so adversely conditioned to sexual situations that they may require 10 to 15 minutes of the most careful stimulation to bring them to climax, and considering the fair number of females who never come to climax in their whole lives, it is, of course, demanding that the male be quite abnormal in his ability to prolong sexual activity without ejaculation if he is required to match the female partner. It is said that in India, the husband, while fulfilling his conjugal duties, smokes his pipe to distract himself from his own pleasure and to make his wife's last. In the West, it is more the number of times that a Casanova boasts of, and his supreme pride is to have a woman beg for mercy. According to erotic tradition, this is not often a successful feat. Men often complain of their partner's exacting demands. She is a wild uterus, an ogre, insatiable. She is never assuaged. Montaigne demonstrates this point of view in the 3rd book of his essays. "They are incomparably more capable and ardent than we in the acts of love, and that priest of antiquity so testified, who had once been a man and then a woman. And besides, we have learned from their own mouth the proof that was once given in different centuries by an emperor and an empress of Rome, master workmen and famous in this task. He indeed deflowered in one night 10 captive Sarmatian virgins, but she actually in one night was good for 25 encounters, changing company according to her need and liking. Ad hoc ardens rigidae, tentegine volvo, et lassata viris, nectum satiata recessite." Note, Juvenal. Her secret parts burning are tense with lust, and tired by men, but far from sated, she withdrew. Translation. We know about the dispute that occurred in Catalonia from a woman complaining of the over-assiduous efforts of her husband. Not so much, in my opinion, that she was bothered by them, for I believe in miracles only in matters of faith. There intervened that notable sentence of the Queen of Aragon, by which, after a mature deliberation with her council, this good queen ordained as the legitimate and necessary limit the number of 6 a day, relinquishing and giving up much of the need and desire of her sex, in order, she said, to establish an easy and consequently permanent and immutable formula. It is true that sexual pleasure for woman is not at all the same as for man. I have already said that it is not known exactly if vaginal pleasure ever results in a definite orgasm. Feminine confidences on this point are rare, and even when they try to be precise, they remain extremely vague. Reactions seem to vary greatly according to the subject. What is certain is that coitus for man has a precise biological end, ejaculation, and certainly many other very complex intentions are involved in aiming at this end. But once obtained, it is seen as an achievement, and if not as the satisfaction of desire, at least as its suppression. On the other hand, the aim for woman is uncertain in the beginning and more psychic than physiological. She desires arousal and sexual pleasure in general, but her body does not project any clear conclusion of the love act, and thus for her, coitus is never fully completed. It does not include any finality. Male pleasure soars, When it reaches a certain threshold, it fulfills itself and dies abruptly in the orgasm. The structure of the sexual act is finite and discontinuous. Feminine pleasure radiates through the whole body. It is not always centered in the genital system. Vaginal contractions, then, even more than a true orgasm, constitute a system of undulations that rhythmically arise, subside, reform, reach for some instance a paroxysm, then blur and dissolve without ever completely dying. Because no fixed goal is assigned to it, pleasure aims at infinity. Nervous or cardiac fatigue or psychic satiety often limits the woman's erotic possibilities rather than precise satisfaction. Even fully fulfilled, even exhausted, she is never totally released. Lassata nectum satiata, according to Juvenal. Man commits a grave error when he attempts to impose his own rhythm on his partner and when he is determined to give her an orgasm. Often he only manages to destroy the form of pleasure she was experiencing in her own way. Note, Lawrence clearly saw the opposition of these two erotic forms, but it is arbitrary to declare, as he does, that the woman must not experience orgasm. It might be an error to try to provoke it at all costs, but it is also an error to reject it in all cases, as Don Cipriano does in The Plumed Serpent. This form is malleable enough to give itself a conclusion. Spasms localized in the vagina or in the whole genital system or coming from the whole body can constitute a resolution. For certain women, they are produced fairly regularly and with sufficient violence to be likened to an orgasm. But a woman lover can also find a conclusion in the masculine orgasm that calms and satisfies her. And it is also possible that in a gradual and gentle way, the erotic phase dissolves calmly. Success requires not a mathematical synchronization of pleasure, whatever many meticulous but simplistic men believe, but the establishment of a complex erotic form. Many think that making a woman come is a question of time and technique, therefore of violence. They disregard the extent to which woman's sexuality is conditioned by the situation as a whole. Sexual pleasure for her, we have said, is a kind of spell. It demands total abandon. If words or gestures contest the magic of caresses, the spell vanishes. This is one of the reasons that the woman often closes her eyes. Physiologically, there is a reflex that compensates for the dilation of the pupil, but even in the dark, she still lowers her eyelids. She wants to do away with the setting, the singularity of the moment, herself and her lover. She wants to lose herself within the carnal night, as indistinct as the maternal breast. And even more particularly, she wants to abolish the separation that sets the male in front of her. She wants to merge with him. We have said already that she desires to remain a subject while making herself an object. More deeply alienated than man, as her whole body is desire and arousal, she remains a subject only through union with her partner. Receiving and giving have to merge for both of them. If the man just takes without giving, or if he gives pleasure without taking, she feels used. As soon as she realizes herself as other, she is the inessential other. She has to invalidate alterity. Thus, the moment of the separation of bodies is almost always painful for her. Man, after coitus, whether he feels sad or joyous, duped by nature or conqueror of woman, whatever the case, he repudiates the flesh. He becomes a whole body. He wants to sleep, take a bath, smoke a cigarette, get a breath of fresh air. She would like to prolong the bodily contact until the spell that made her flesh dissipates completely. Separation is a painful wrenching, like a new weaning. She resents the lover who pulls away from her too abruptly. But what wounds her even more are the words that contest the fusion in which she believed for a moment. The wife of Gilles, whose story Madeleine Bourdoux told, pulls back when her husband asks her, "Did you come?" She puts her hand on his mouth. Many women hate this word because it reduces the pleasure to an imminent and separated sensation. Is it enough? Do you want more? Was it good? The very fact of asking the question points out the separation and changes the love act into a mechanical operation, assumed and controlled by the male. And this is precisely the reason he asks it. Much more than fusion and reciprocity, he seeks domination. When the unity of the couple is undone, he becomes the sole subject. A great deal of love or generosity is necessary to give up this privilege. He likes the woman to feel humiliated, possessed in spite of herself. He always wants to take her a little more than she gives herself. Woman would be spared many difficulties were man not to trail behind him so many complexes, making him consider the love act a battle. Then it would be possible for her not to consider the bed as an arena. However, along with narcissism and pride, one observes in the young girl a desire to be dominated. According to some psychoanalysts, masochism is a characteristic of women, by means of which they can adapt to their erotic destiny. But the notion of masochism is very confused and has to be considered attentively. Freudian psychoanalysts distinguish three forms of masochism. One is the link between pain and sexual pleasure. Another is the feminine acceptance of erotic dependence. And the last resides in a mechanism of self-punishment. Woman is masochistic because pleasure and pain in her are linked through defloration and birth, and because she consents to her passive role. It must first be pointed out that attributing erotic value to pain does not in any way constitute behavior of passive submission. Pain often serves to raise the tonus of the individual who experiences it, to awaken a sensitivity numbed by the very violence of arousal and pleasure. It is a sharp light bursting out in the carnal night. It removes the lover from the limbo where he is swooning, so that he might once more be thrown into it. Pain is normally part of erotic frenzy. Bodies that delight in being bodies for their reciprocal joy seek to find each other, unite with each other, and confront each other in every possible way. There is a wrenching from oneself in eroticism, a transport, an ecstasy. Suffering also destroys the limits of the self. It is a going beyond and a paroxysm. Pain has always played a big role in orgies, and it is well known that the exquisite and the painful converge. A caress can become torture. Torment gives pleasure. Embracing easily leads to biting, pinching, scratching. Such behavior is not generally sadistic. It expresses a desire to merge and not to destroy. And the subject that submits to it does not seek to disavow and humiliate himself, but to unite. Besides, it is far from being specifically masculine. In fact, pain has a masochistic meaning only when it is grasped and desired as the manifestation of enslavement. As for the pain of defloration, it is specifically not accompanied by pleasure. And all women fear the suffering of giving birth, and they are happy that modern methods free them from it. Pain has neither more nor less place in their sexuality than in that of man. Feminine docility is, moreover, a very equivocal notion. We have seen that most of the time the young girl accepts in her imagination the domination of a demigod, a hero, a male, but it is still only a narcissistic game. She is in no way disposed to submit to the carnal expression of this authority in reality. By contrast, she refuses to give herself to a man she admires and respects, giving herself to an ordinary man instead. It is an error to seek the key to concrete behavior in fantasy, because fantasies are created and cherished as fantasies. The little girl who dreams of rape with a mixture of horror and complicity does not desire to be raped, and the event, if it occurred, would be a loathsome catastrophe. We have already seen in Maria Le Ardouin a typical example of this dissociation. She writes, "But there remained an area on the path of abolition that I only entered with pinched nostrils and a beating heart. This was the path that beyond amorous sensuality led me to sensuality itself. There was no deceitful infamy that I did not commit in dreams. I suffered from the need to affirm myself in every possible way." Note, The Black Sail. The case of Marie Bashkirtseff should also be recalled. "All my life I have tried to place myself voluntarily under some kind of illusory domination. But all the people I tried were so ordinary in comparison with me that all I felt for them was disgust. Moreover, it is true that the woman's sexual role is largely passive, but to live this passive situation in its immediacy is no more masochistic than the male's normal aggressiveness is sadistic. Woman can transcend caresses, arousal, and penetration toward achieving her own pleasure, thus maintaining the affirmation of her subjectivity. She can also seek union with the lover and give herself to him, which signifies a surpassing of herself and not an abdication. Masochism exists when the individual chooses to constitute himself as a pure thing through the consciousness of the other, to represent oneself to oneself as a thing, to play at being a thing. Masochism is an attempt not to fascinate the other by my objectivity, but to make myself be fascinated by my objectivity for others. Note, J.P. Sartre, Being and Nothingness. Sade's Juliette, or The Young Virgin from La Philosophie dans le Boudoir, Philosophy in the Boudoir, who both give themselves to the male in all possible ways, but for their own pleasure, are not in any way masochists. Lady Chatterley and Kate, in the total abandon they consent to, are not masochists. To speak of masochism, one has to posit the self, and this alienated double has to be considered as founded on the other's freedom. In this sense, true masochism can be found in some women. The young girl is susceptible to it since she is easily narcissistic, and narcissism consists in alienating oneself and one's ego. If she experienced arousal and violent desire right from the beginning of her erotic initiation, she would live her experiences authentically and stop projecting them toward this ideal pole that she calls self. But in frigidity, the self continues to affirm itself. Making it the thing of a male seems then like a fault. But masochism, like sadism, is the assumption of guilt. I am guilty due to the very fact that I am an object. This idea of Sartre's fits in with the Freudian notion of self-punishment. The young girl considers herself guilty of delivering herself to another, and she punishes herself for it by willingly increasing humiliation and subjugation. We have seen that virgins defied their future lovers and punished themselves for their future submission by inflicting various tortures on themselves. When the lover is real and present, they persist in this attitude. Frigidity itself can be seen as a punishment that woman imposes as much on herself as on her partner. Wounded in her vanity, she resents him and herself, and she does not permit herself pleasure. In masochism, she will wildly enslave herself to the male. She will tell him words of adoration. She will wish to be humiliated, beaten. She will alienate herself more and more deeply out of fury for having agreed to the alienation. This is quite obviously Mathilde La Mole's behavior, for example. She regrets having given herself to Julien, which is why she sometimes falls at his feet, bends over backward to indulge each of his whims, sacrifices her hair, but at the same time, she is in revolt against him as much as against herself. One imagines that she is icy in his arms. The fake abandon of the masochistic woman creates new barriers that keep her from pleasure, and at the same time, she is taking vengeance against herself for this inability to experience pleasure. The vicious circle from frigidity to masochism can establish itself forever, bringing sadistic behavior along with it as compensation. Becoming erotically mature can also deliver woman from her frigidity and her narcissism, and assuming her sexual passivity, she lives it immediately instead of playing the role. Because the paradox of masochism is that the subject reaffirms itself constantly, even in its attempt to abdicate itself, it is in the gratuitous gift, in the spontaneous movement toward the other, that he succeeds in forgetting himself. It is thus true that woman will be more prone than man to masochistic temptation. Her erotic situation as passive object commits her to playing passivity. This game is the self-punishment to which her narcissistic revolts and consequent frigidity lead her. The fact is that many women, and in particular young girls, are masochists. Colette, speaking of her first amorous experiences, confides to us in Mes Apprentissages, My Apprenticeships. Ridden by youth and ignorance, I had known intoxication, a guilty rapture, an atrocious, impure adolescent impulse. There are many scarcely nubile girls who dream of becoming the show, the plaything, the licentious masterpiece of some middle-aged man. It is an ugly dream that is punished by its fulfillment, a morbid thing, akin to the neuroses of puberty, the habit of eating chalk and coal, of drinking mouthwash, of reading dirty books, and sticking pins into the palm of the hand. This perfectly expresses the fact that masochism is part of juvenile perversions, that it is not an authentic solution of the conflict created by woman's sexual destiny, but a way of escaping it by wallowing in it. In no way does it represent the normal and happy blossoming of feminine eroticism. This blossoming supposes that, in love, tenderness, and sensuality, woman succeeds in overcoming her passivity and establishing a relationship of reciprocity with her partner. The asymmetry of male and female eroticism creates insoluble problems as long as there is a battle of the sexes. They can easily be settled when a woman feels both desire and respect in a man. If he covets her in her flesh while recognizing her freedom, she recovers her essentialness at the moment she becomes object. She remains free in the submission to which she consents. Thus, the lovers can experience shared pleasure in their own way. Each partner feels pleasure as being his own, while at the same time having its source in the other. The words receive and give exchange meanings. Joy is gratitude, pleasure is tenderness. In a concrete and sexual form, the reciprocal recognition of the self and the other is accomplished in the keenest consciousness of the other and the self. Some women say they feel the masculine sex organ in themselves as a part of their own body. Some men think they are the woman they penetrate. These expressions are obviously inaccurate. The dimension of the other remains, but the fact is that alterity no longer has a hostile character. This consciousness of the union of the bodies in their separation is what makes the sexual act moving. It is all the more overwhelming that the two beings who together passionately negate and affirm their limits are fellow creatures and yet are different. This difference that all too often isolates them becomes the source of their marveling when they join together. Woman recognizes the virile passion in man's force as the reverse of the fever that burns within her. And this is the power she wields over him. This sex organ, swollen with life, belongs to her, just as her smile belongs to the man who gives her pleasure. All the treasures of virility and femininity reflecting off and reappropriating each other make a moving and ecstatic unity. What is necessary for such harmony are not technical refinements, but rather, on the basis of an immediate erotic attraction, a reciprocal generosity of body and soul. This generosity is often hampered in man by his vanity and in woman by her timidity. If she does not overcome her inhibitions, she will not be able to make it thrive. This is why full sexual blossoming in woman arrives rather late. She reaches her erotic peak at about 35. Unfortunately, if she is married, her husband is too used to her frigidity. She can still seduce new lovers, but she is beginning to fade. Time is running out. At the very moment they cease to be desirable, many women finally decide to assume their desires. The conditions under which woman's sexual life unfolds depend not only on these facts, but also on her whole social and economic situation. It would be too vague to attempt to study this further without this context. But several generally valid conclusions emerge from our examination. The erotic experience is one that most poignantly reveals to human beings their ambiguous condition. They experience it as flesh and as spirit, as the other and as subject. Woman experiences this conflict at its most dramatic because she assumes herself first as object and does not immediately find a confident autonomy and pleasure. She has to reconquer her dignity as transcendent and free subject while assuming her carnal condition. This is a delicate and risky enterprise that often fails. But the very difficulty of her situation protects her from the mystifications by which the male lets himself be duped. He is easily deceived by the fallacious privileges that his aggressive role and satisfied solitude of orgasm imply. He hesitates to recognize himself fully as flesh. Woman has a more authentic experience of herself. Even if woman accommodates herself more or less exactly to her passive role, she is still frustrated as an active individual. She does not envy man his organ of possession. She envies in him his prey. It is a curious paradox that man lives in a sensual world of sweetness, tenderness, softness, a feminine world, while woman moves in the hard and harsh male universe. Her hands still long for the embrace of smooth skin and soft flesh. Adolescent boy, woman, flowers, furs, child. A whole part of herself remains available and wishes to possess a treasure similar to the one she gives the male. This explains why there subsists in many women, in a more or less latent form, a tendency toward homosexuality. For a set of complex reasons, there are those for whom this tendency asserts itself with particular authority. Not all women agree to give their sexual problems the one classic solution officially accepted by society. Thus, must we envisage those who choose forbidden paths. Chapter 4. The Lesbian. People are always ready to see the lesbian as wearing a felt hat, her hair short, and a necktie. Her mannishness is seen as an abnormality indicating a hormonal imbalance. Nothing could be more erroneous than this confusion of the homosexual and the virago. There are many homosexual women among odalisques, courtesans, and the most deliberately feminine women. By contrast, a great number of masculine women are heterosexual. Sexologists and psychiatrists confirm what ordinary observation suggests. The immense majority of cursed women are constituted exactly like other women. Their sexuality is not determined by anatomical destiny. There are certainly cases where physiological givens create particular situations. There is no rigorous biological distinction between the two sexes. An identical soma is modified by hormonal activity whose orientation is genotypically defined, but can be diverted in the course of the fetus's development. This results in individuals halfway between male and female. Some men take on a feminine appearance because of late development of their male organs, and sometimes girls as well, athletic ones in particular, change into boys. Helena Deutsch tells of a young girl who ardently courted a married woman, wanted to run off and live with her. She realized one day that she was in fact a man, so she was able to marry her beloved and have children. But it must not be concluded that every homosexual woman is a hidden man in false guise. The hermaphrodite, who has elements of two genital systems, often has a female sexuality. I knew of one, exiled by the Nazis from Vienna, who greatly regretted her inability to appeal to either heterosexuals or homosexuals, as she loved only men. Under the influence of male hormones, viriloid women present masculine secondary sexual characteristics. In infantile women, female hormones are deficient, and their development remains incomplete. These particularities can more or less directly trigger a lesbian orientation. A person with a vigorous, aggressive, and exuberant vitality wishes to exert himself actively and usually rejects passivity. An unattractive and malformed woman may try to compensate for her inferiority by acquiring virile attributes. If her erogenous sensitivity is undeveloped, she does not desire masculine caresses. But anatomy and hormones never define anything but a situation, and do not posit the object toward which the situation will be transcended. Deutsch also cites the case of a wounded Polish legionnaire she treated during World War I, who was in fact a young girl with marked viriloid characteristics. She had joined the army as a nurse, then succeeded in wearing the uniform. She nevertheless fell in love with a soldier, whom she later married, which caused her to be regarded as a male homosexual. Her masculine behavior did not contradict a feminine type of eroticism. Man himself does not exclusively desire woman. The fact that the male homosexual body can be perfectly virile implies that a woman's virility does not necessarily destine her to homosexuality. Even in women physiologically normal themselves, it has sometimes been asserted that there is a distinction between clitoral and vaginal women, the former being destined to sapphic love, but it has been seen that all childhood eroticism is clitoral. Whether it remains fixed at this stage or is transformed has nothing to do with anatomical facts, nor is it true, as has often been maintained, that infant masturbation explains the ulterior primacy of the clitoral system. A child's masturbation is recognized today by sexologists as an absolutely normal and generally widespread phenomenon. The development of feminine eroticism is, we have seen, a psychological situation in which physiological factors are included, but which depends on the subject's overall attitude to existence. Marignon considered sexuality to be one way, and that man attains a completed form of it, while for woman it remains halfway. Only the lesbian could possess a libido as rich as a male's, and would thus be a superior feminine type. In fact, feminine sexuality has its own structure, and the idea of a hierarchy in male and female libidos is absurd. The choice of sexual object in no way depends on the amount of energy woman might have. Psychoanalysts have had the great merit of seeing a psychic phenomenon and not an organic one in inversion. To them, nonetheless, it still seems determined by external circumstances. But in fact, they have not studied it very much. According to Freud, female erotic maturation requires the passage from the clitoral to the vaginal stage, symmetrical with the change transferring the love the little girl felt first for her mother to her father. Various factors may hinder this development. The woman is not resigned to castration, hides the absence of the penis from herself, or remains fixated on her mother, for whom she seeks substitutes. For Adler, this fixation is not a passively endured accident. It is desired by the subject who, in her will for power, deliberately denies her mutilation and seeks to identify with the man whose domination she refuses. Whether from infantile fixation or masculine protest, homosexuality would appear in any case as unfinished development. In truth, the lesbian is no more a failed woman than a superior woman. The individual's history is not an inevitable progression. At every step, the past is grasped anew by a new choice, and the normality of the choice confers no privileged value on it. It must be judged by its authenticity. Homosexuality can be a way for woman to flee her condition or a way to assume it. Psychoanalysts' great error through moralizing conformity is that they never envisage it as anything but an inauthentic attitude. Woman is an existent who is asked to make herself object. As subject, she has an aggressive sensuality that does not find satisfaction in the masculine body. From this are born the conflicts her eroticism must overcome. The system is considered normal that delivering her as prey to a male restores her sovereignty by putting a baby in her arms. But this naturalism is determined by a more or less well-understood social interest. Even heterosexuality permits other solutions. Homosexuality for woman is one attempt among others to reconcile her autonomy with the passivity of her flesh. And if nature is invoked, it could be said that every woman is naturally homosexual. The lesbian is characterized simply by her refusal of the male and her preference for feminine flesh. But every adolescent female fears penetration and masculine domination, and she feels a certain repulsion for the man's body. On the contrary, the feminine body is for her, as for man, an object of desire. As I have already said, men posit themselves as subjects. and at the same time they posit themselves as separate. To consider the other as a thing to take is to attack the virile ideal in the other, and thus jointly in oneself as well. By contrast, the woman who regards herself as object sees herself and her fellow creatures as prey. The homosexual man inspires hostility from male and female heterosexuals as they both demand that man be a dominating subject. Note, a heterosexual woman can easily have a friendship with certain homosexual men because she finds security and amusement in these asexual relations. But on the whole, she feels hostile toward these men who in themselves or in others degrade the sovereign male into a passive thing. By contrast, both sexes spontaneously view lesbians with indulgence. "I swear," says the Comte de Tilly, "it is a rivalry that in no way bothers me. On the contrary, I find it amusing, and I am immoral enough to laugh at it." Colette attributed the same amused indifference to Renaud, faced with the couple Claudine and Rézy. Note, it is noteworthy that English law punishes homosexuality in men while not considering it a crime for women. A man is more irritated by an active and autonomous heterosexual woman than by a non-aggressive homosexual one. Only the former challenges masculine prerogatives. Sapphic loves in no way contradict the traditional model of the division of the sexes. In most cases, they are an assumption of femininity and not a rejection of it. We have seen that they often appear in the adolescent girl as an ersatz form of heterosexual relations she has not yet had the opportunity or the audacity to experience. It is a stage, an apprenticeship, and the one who most ardently engages in such loves may tomorrow be the most ardent of wives, lovers, and mothers. What must be explained in the female homosexual is thus not the positive aspect of her choice, but the negative side. She is not characterized by her preference for women, but by the exclusiveness of this preference. According to Jones and Enar, lesbians mostly fall into two categories: masculine lesbians who try to act like men, and feminine ones who are afraid of men. It is a fact that one can, on the whole, observe two tendencies in homosexual women. Some refuse passivity, while others choose to lose themselves passively in feminine arms. But these two attitudes react upon each other reciprocally. Relations to the chosen object and to the rejected one are explained by each other reciprocally. For numerous reasons, as we shall see, the distinction given seems quite arbitrary. To define the lesbian as virile because of her desire to imitate man is to doom her to inauthenticity. I have already said how psychoanalysts create ambiguities by accepting masculine-feminine categories as currently defined by society. Thus, man today represents the positive and the neuter, that is, the male and the human being, while woman represents the negative, the female. Every time she behaves like a human being, she is declared to be identifying with the male. Her sports, her political and intellectual activities, and her desire for other women are interpreted as masculine protest. There is a refusal to take into account the values toward which she is transcending, which inevitably leads to the belief that she is making the inauthentic choice of a subjective attitude. The great misunderstanding upon which this system of interpretation rests is to hold that it is natural for the human female to make a feminine woman of herself. Being a heterosexual or even a mother is not enough to realize this ideal. The real woman is an artificial product that civilization produces the way eunuchs were produced in the past. These supposed instincts of coquetry or docility are inculcated in her just as phallic pride is for man. He does not always accept his virile vocation. She has good reasons to accept even less docilely the vocation assigned to her. The notions of inferiority complex and masculinity complex remind me of the anecdote that Denis de Rougemont recounts in La Part du Diable, The Devil's Share. A woman imagined that birds were attacking her when she went walking in the country, after several months of psychoanalytical treatment that failed to cure her of her obsession. The doctor accompanied her to the clinic garden and realized that the birds were attacking her. Woman feels undermined because, in fact, the restrictions of femininity undermine her. She spontaneously chooses to be a complete individual, a subject, and a freedom before whom the world and future open. If this choice amounts to the choice of virility, it does so to the extent that femininity today means mutilation. Homosexuals' confessions collected by Havelock Ellis and Stekel, platonic in the first case and openly declared in the second, clearly show that feminine specificity is what outrages the two subjects. Ever since I can remember anything at all, I could never think of myself as a girl, and I was in perpetual trouble, with this as the real reason. When I was 5 or 6 years old, I began to say to myself that whatever anyone said, if I was not a boy, at any rate, I was not a girl. I regarded the conformation of my body as a mysterious accident. When I could only crawl, my absorbing interest was hammers and carpet nails. Before I could walk, I begged to be put on horses' backs. By the time I was 7, it seemed to me that everything I liked was called wrong for a girl. I was not at all a happy little child, and often cried and was made irritable. I was so confused by the talk about boys and girls. Every half-holiday, I went out with the boys from my brother's school. When I was about 11, my parents got more mortified at my behavior and perpetually threatened me with a boarding school. My going was finally announced to me as a punishment to me for being what I was. In whatever direction my thoughts ran, I always surveyed them from the point of view of a boy. A consideration of social matters led me to feel very sorry for women, whom I regarded as made by a deliberate process of manufacture into the fools I thought they were, and by the same process that I myself was being made one. I felt more and more that men were to be envied and women pitied. I lay stress on this, for it started in me a deliberate interest in women as women. I began to feel protective and kindly toward women. As for Stekel's transvestite, until her 6th year, in spite of assertions of those around her, she thought she was a boy, dressed like a girl for reasons unknown to her. At 6, she told herself, I'll be a lieutenant, and if God wills it, a marshal. She often dreamed of mounting a horse and riding out of town at the head of an army. Though very intelligent, she was miserable to be transferred from an ordinary school to a lycée. She was afraid of becoming effeminate. This revolt by no means implies a sapphic predestination. Most little girls feel the same indignation and despair when they learn that the accidental conformation of their bodies condemns their tastes and aspirations. Colette Audry angrily discovered at the age of 12 that she could never become a sailor. Note, in the eyes of memory. The future woman naturally feels indignant about the limitations her sex imposes on her. The question is not why she rejects them. The real problem is rather to understand why she accepts them. Her conformism comes from her docility and timidity, but this resignation will easily turn to revolt if society's compensations are judged inadequate. This is what will happen in cases where the adolescent girl feels unattractive as a woman. Anatomical configurations become particularly important when this happens. If she is or believes she is ugly or has a bad figure, woman rejects a feminine destiny for which she feels ill-adapted. But it would be wrong to say that she acquires a mannish attitude to compensate for a lack of femininity. Rather, the opportunities offered to the adolescent girl in exchange for the masculine advantages she is asked to sacrifice seem too meager to her. All little girls envy boys' practical clothes. It is their reflection in the mirror and the promises of things to come that make their furbelows, little by little, all the more precious. If the mirror harshly reflects an ordinary face, if it offers no promise, then lace and ribbons are an embarrassing, even ridiculous livery, and the tomboy obstinately wishes to remain a boy. Even if she has a good figure and is pretty, the woman who is involved in her own projects or who claims her freedom in general refuses to abdicate in favor of another human being. She recognizes herself in her acts not in her imminent presence. Male desire reducing her to the limits of her body shocks her as much as it shocks a young boy. She feels the same disgust for her submissive female companions as the virile man feels for the passive homosexual. She adopts a masculine attitude in part to repudiate any involvement with them. She disguises her clothes, her looks, and her language. She forms a couple with a female friend where she assumes the male role. This play-acting is, in fact, a masculine protest. But it is a secondary phenomenon. What is spontaneous is the conquering and sovereign subject's shame at the idea of changing into a carnal prey. Many women athletes are homosexual. They do not perceive this body that is muscle, movement, extension, and momentum as passive flesh. It does not magically beckon caresses. It is a hold on the world, not a thing of the world. The gap between the body for itself and the body for others seems in this case to be unbreachable. Analogous resistance is found in women of action, brainy types for whom even carnal submission is impossible. Were equality of the sexes concretely realized, this obstacle would be in large part eradicated. But man is still imbued with his own sense of superiority, which is a disturbing conviction for the woman who does not share it. It should be noted, however, that the most willful and domineering women seldom hesitate to confront the male. The woman considered virile is often clearly heterosexual. She does not want to renounce her claims as a human being, but she has no intention of mutilating her femininity either. She chooses to enter the masculine world, even to annex it for herself. Her robust sensuality has no fear of male roughness. She has fewer defenses to overcome than the timid virgin in finding joy in a man's body. A rude and animal nature will not feel the humiliation of coitus. An intellectual with an intrepid mind will challenge it. Sure of herself and in a fighting mood, a woman will gladly engage in a duel she is sure to win. George Sand had a predilection for young and feminine men, but Madame de Stael looked for youth and beauty only in her later life, dominating men by her sharp mind and proudly accepting their admiration. She could hardly have felt a prey in their arms. A sovereign such as Catherine the Great could even allow herself masochistic ecstasies. She alone remained the master in these games. Isabel Eberhardt, who dressed as a man and traversed the Sahara on horseback, felt no less diminished when she gave herself to some vigorous sharpshooter. The woman who refuses to be the man's vassal is far from always fleeing him. Rather, she tries to make him the instrument of her pleasure. In certain favorable circumstances, mainly dependent on her partner, the very notion of competition will disappear, and she will enjoy experiencing her woman's condition just as man experiences his. But this arrangement between her active personality and her role as passive female is nevertheless more difficult for her than for man. Rather than wear themselves out in this effort, many women will give up trying. There are numerous lesbians among women artists and writers. It is not because their sexual specificity is the source of creative energy or a manifestation of the existence of this superior energy. It is rather that, being absorbed in serious work, they do not intend to waste their time playing the woman's role or struggling against men. Not admitting male superiority, they do not wish to pretend to accept it or tire themselves contesting it. They seek release, peace, and diversion in sexual pleasure. They could spend their time more profitably without a partner who acts like an adversary, and so they free themselves from the chains attached to femininity. Of course, the nature of her heterosexual experiences will often lead the virile woman to choose between assuming or repudiating her sex. Masculine disdain confirms the feeling of unattractiveness in an ugly woman. A lover's arrogance will wound a proud woman. All the motives for frigidity we have envisaged are found here: resentment, spite, fear of pregnancy, abortion trauma, and so on. They become all the weightier the more woman defies man. However, homosexuality is not always an entirely satisfactory solution for a domineering woman. Since she seeks to affirm herself, it vexes her not to fully realize her feminine possibilities. Heterosexual relations seem to her at once an impoverishment and an enrichment. In repudiating the limitations implied by her sex, she may limit herself in another way. Just as the frigid woman desires pleasure even while rejecting it, the lesbian would often like to be a normal and complete woman while at the same time not wanting it. This hesitation is evident in the case of the transvestite studied by Schlegel. We have seen that she was only comfortable with boys and did not want to become effeminate. At 16 years of age, she formed her first relations with young girls. She had a profound contempt for them, which gave her eroticism a sadistic quality. She ardently, but platonically, courted a friend she respected. She felt disgust for those she possessed. She threw herself fiercely into difficult studies. Disappointed by her first serious sapphic love affair, she frenetically indulged in purely sensual experiences and began to drink. At 17, she met the young man she married, but she thought of him as her wife. She dressed in a masculine way, and she continued to drink and study. At first, she only had vaginismus, and intercourse never produced an orgasm. She considered her position humiliating. She was always the one to take the aggressive and active role. She left her husband even while being madly in love with him and took up relations with women again. She met a male artist to whom she gave herself, but still without an orgasm. Her life was divided into clearly defined periods. For a while, she wrote, worked creatively, and felt completely male. She episodically and sadistically slept with women during these periods. Then she would have a female period. She underwent analysis because she wanted to reach orgasm. The lesbian would easily be able to consent to the loss of her femininity if in doing so she gained triumphant masculinity. But no, she obviously remains deprived of the virile organ. She can deflower her girlfriend with her hand or use an artificial penis to imitate possession, but she is still a eunuch. She may suffer acutely from this because she is incomplete as a woman, impotent as a man. Her malaise sometimes manifests itself in psychoses. A patient told Roland Dalbier, "It would be better if I had a thing to penetrate with." Note, la méthode psychanalytique et la doctrine freudienne. Psychoanalytical method and the doctrine of Freud. Another wished that her breasts were rigid. The lesbian will often try to compensate for her virile inferiority by arrogance or exhibitionism, which in fact reveals inner imbalance. Sometimes, also, she will succeed in establishing with other women a type of relation completely analogous to those a feminine man or an adolescent still unsure of his virility might have with them. A striking case of such a destiny is that of Sandor, reported by Croft Abing. She uses this means to attain a perfect balance destroyed only by the intervention of society. Sarolta came of a titled Hungarian family known for its eccentricities. Her father had her reared as a boy, calling her Sandor. She rode horseback, hunted, and so on. She was under such influences until at 13 she was placed in an institution. A little later, she fell in love with an English girl, pretending to be a boy, and ran away with her. At home again, she resumed the name Sandor and wore boys' clothing while being carefully educated. She went on long trips with her father, always in male attire. She was addicted to sports, drank, and visited brothels. She felt particularly drawn toward actresses and other such detached women, preferably not too young, but feminine in nature. "It delighted me," she related, "if the passion of a lady was disclosed under a poetic veil. All immodesty in a woman was disgusting to me. I had an indescribable aversion to female attire, indeed, for everything feminine. But only insofar as it concerned me, for on the other hand, I was all enthusiasm for the beautiful sex." She had numerous affairs with women and spent a good deal of money on them. At the same time, she was a valued contributor to two important journals. She lived for 3 years in marriage with a woman 10 years older than herself, from whom she broke away only with great difficulty. She was able to inspire violent passions, Falling in love with a young teacher, she was married to her in an elaborate ceremony, the girl and her family believing her to be a man. Her father-in-law, on one occasion, noticed what seemed to be an erection, probably a priapus. She shaved as a matter of form, but servants in the hotel room suspected the truth from seeing blood on her bedclothes and from spying through the keyhole. Thus unmasked, Sandor was put in prison and later acquitted after thorough investigation. She was greatly saddened by her enforced separation from her beloved Marie, to whom she wrote long and impassioned letters from her cell. The examination showed that her conformation was not wholly feminine. Her pelvis was small, and she had no waist. Her breasts were developed, her sexual parts quite feminine but not maturely formed. Her menstruation appeared late, at 17, and she felt a profound horror of the function. She was equally horrified at the thought of sexual relations with the male. Her sense of modesty was developed only in regard to women, and to the point that she would feel less shyness in going to bed with a man than with a woman. It was very embarrassing for her to be treated as a woman, and she was truly in anguish at having to wear feminine clothes. She felt that she was drawn as by a magnetic force toward women of 24 to 30. She found sexual satisfaction exclusively in caressing her loved one, never in being caressed. At times, she made use of a stocking stuffed with oakum as a priapus. She detested men. She was very sensitive to the moral esteem of others. And she had much literary talent, wide culture, and a colossal memory. Note, Croft Abing, Psychopathia Sexualis, translation. Sandor was not psychoanalyzed, but several salient points emerge just from the presentation of the facts. It seems that most spontaneously and without a masculine protest, she always thought of herself as a man, thanks to the way she was brought up and her body's constitution. The way her father included her in his trips and his life obviously had a decisive influence on her. Her virility was so confirmed that she did not show the slightest ambivalence toward women. She loved them like a man, without feeling compromised by them. She loved them in a purely dominating and active way, without accepting reciprocity. However, it is striking that she detested men, and that she particularly cherished older women. This suggests that Sandor had a masculine Oedipus complex vis-à-vis her mother. She perpetuated the infantile attitude of the very young girl who, forming a couple with her mother, nourished the hope of one day protecting and dominating her. Very often the maternal tenderness a child has been deprived of haunts her whole adult life. Raised by her father, Sandor must have dreamed of a loving and treasured mother whom she sought afterward in other women. This explains her deep jealousy of other men, linked to her respect and poetic love for isolated and older women who were endowed in her eyes with a sacred quality. Her attitude was exactly that of Rousseau with Madame de Warens and the young Benjamin Constant concerning Madame de Charrière. Sensitive, feminine adolescent boys also turn to maternal mistresses. This type of lesbian is found in more or less pronounced forms. One who has never identified with her mother, because she either admired her or detested her too much, but who, refusing to be a woman, desires the softness of feminine protection around her. From the bosom of this warm womb, she can emerge into the world with boyish daring. She acts like a man, but as a man, she has a fragility that makes her desire the love of an older mistress. The couple will reproduce the classic heterosexual couple, matron and adolescent boy. Psychoanalysts have clearly noted the importance of the relationship a homosexual woman had earlier with her mother. There are two cases where the adolescent girl has difficulty escaping her influence. If she has been overly protected by an anxious mother, or if she was mistreated by a bad mother who inculcated a deep feeling of guilt in her. In the first case, their relations often bordered on homosexuality. They slept together, caressed, or kissed each other's breasts. The young girl will seek the same pleasure in new arms. In the second case, she will feel an ardent need of a good mother who protects her against her own mother, who removes the curse she feels weighing on her. One of the stories Havelock Ellis recounts concerns a subject who detested her mother throughout her childhood. She describes the love she felt at 16 for an older woman. "I felt like an orphan child who had suddenly acquired a mother, and through her I began to feel less antagonistic to grown people and to feel respect for them. My love for her was perfectly pure, and I thought of hers as simply maternal. I liked her to touch me, and she sometimes held me in her arms or let me sit on her lap. At bedtime, she used to come and say goodnight and kiss me upon the mouth." Note: Studies in the Psychology of Sex, Volume 2, Sexual Inversion, Translation. If the older woman is willing, the younger one will joyfully abandon herself to more ardent embraces. She will usually assume the passive role because she desires to be dominated, protected, rocked, and caressed like a child. Whether these relations remain platonic or become carnal, they often have the characteristics of a truly passionate love. However, the very fact that they appear as a classic stage in the adolescent girl's development means that they cannot suffice to explain a determined choice of homosexuality. The young girl seeks in it both a liberation and a security she can also find in masculine arms. Once the period of amorous enthusiasm has passed, the younger one often experiences the ambivalent feeling for her older partner she felt toward her mother. She falls under her influence while at the same time wishing to extricate herself from it. If the other persists in holding her back, she will remain her prisoner for a time. Note: As in Dorothy Baker's novel Trio, which is, moreover, very superficial. But either in violent scenes or amicably, she will manage to escape. Having succeeded in expunging her adolescence, she feels ready to face a normal woman's life. For her lesbian vocation to affirm itself, either she has to reject her femininity, like Sandor, or her femininity has to flourish more happily in feminine arms. Thus, fixation on the mother is clearly not enough to explain homosexuality, and it can be chosen for completely different reasons.